Today on the Movie Talk Podcast, we're skipping all the news to jump straight into my future review, Dune Part 2.
Your father didn't believe in revenge.
Now I do.
Holy Mother.
Okay, so Part 2 obviously is the sequel to Denis Villeneuve's Dune Part 1, which came out in 2021. This one also obviously directed by Villeneuve, adaptation of the 1965 Frank Herbert novel, which is famous for inspiring Star Wars and being one of the most seminal sci-fi books of all time. So I've read Dune, I've read the book multiple times, I absolutely love it. It's one of my favorite books of all time, and let me give you, first of all, my thoughts on the first Dune movie. I reviewed it back when it came out. I think I even reviewed it twice because I loved it so much, and as I've gone and revisited it in preparation for this movie and rewatched it, I've only grown to love it more. Like, I think that first Dune is a perfect movie. It's one of my favorite movies of all time. I really do think it's as close to flawless as you can get. And that might be a little bit of a hot take because I know there's a lot of criticisms of it being too long or the pacing or whatever. But I really think it's like the prime example of economical storytelling, of just maximizing the impact with the minimum amount of scenes or exposition or explanation, like Duncan Idaho in that movie. He has like maybe 3 scenes in the entire movie and sells this entire arc, this entire relationship with Paul. We get to a point where his sacrifice is impactful and meaningful, and you don't even realize it's only 3 scenes. Like, he's barely in the movie. And then even like simple stuff you don't even notice, like the carryalls. In the first Dune, they show a scene of the carryalls working, and it grabs onto the harvester and lifts the harvester up, and it's just a quick moment that you don't even really notice. But then 20 minutes later, when we're out in the desert and the carryall fails, they don't have to give us any exposition. It is just ultimately and instantly very clear, okay, it's failing, this is not how it looked 20 minutes ago, clearly something's wrong. And it's all in the visual storytelling, it's all in the setup and payoff, it's all in the just simple things, like seeing something earlier that'll come back later. Like, it's very basic storytelling stuff that Denis Villeneuve employs, but the way he uses it, I think, is really well done and goes a little bit unrecognized. I feel like so much attention is paid to the visuals and the grandeur and the spectacle of these movies, and not the storytelling, when I think the storytelling is really, really smart. So that's my thoughts on the first Dune. Also, I wanted to talk about my thoughts on like adaptations, because, you know, there's obviously the phrase that like the movie is never as good as the book or whatever. And I actually think that's not true. I think that's also just the wrong way to look at it. Like, adaptation is not meant to be a perfect one-to-one translation. A good adaptation retains the core themes and the ideas of the work, but changes them and evolves them and adapts them. And in the best case scenario of an adaptation, you end up with 2 different works of art that have different identities and are different things, but are complementary and ultimately can be viewed together to enrich the greater experience of this story or this painting or this book or whatever it is. And I really do think these Dune movies are the perfect example of that, because they are very different from the book, not at all similar, lots of changes, lots of departures, but they totally work in tandem and they enrich the book and the book enriches the movie, and they're different, but they're similar, and you can read the book, then watch the movies and get 2 different takes and 2 different artistic visions, but still kind of get a really complete, rich, comprehensive Dune experience. So I love the first Dune, blah, 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 great adaptation. And it's very safe to say I was very excited for Dune Part 2. It's been my most anticipated movie since the first one. And overall, I mean, everything I just said about the first one absolutely also applies to this one. It really does feel like one of those special generational epics. It's like once every 20 years or so, there's one of these special trilogies, whether it's Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, whatever it is. And it does feel like Dune is this generation's version of that. So yeah, I loved Dune Part 2. I can't say I have a favorite. I don't think one's better than the other, because I really do see them as two halves of the same whole. I don't really see it as like original and then sequel. And I know I'm insane, but I really cannot wait to be able to watch these two back to back as one long 5.5 hour movie. There's not many things I would do that for, but for Dune, I cannot wait to do that. And I think the experience is going to be even better as that full 5.5 hour long movie. So yeah, I love Dune Part 2. I think the main success of this movie and the most important thing that it had to get right and other adaptations have missed is the core of Frank Herbert's book, which is that it's a cautionary tale. Dune is not a triumphant story. It's actually the opposite. And Villeneuve just really captures this. I'm a big fan of his. I've been a fan of his. I think he's the master of like bleak nihilism. He does a lot of like really dark endings and tackles dark themes. And this is obviously, it's no Sicario, it's no Prisoners, it's not even Incendies, but this movie is pretty bleak. It's pretty dark for a modern blockbuster. The ending is pretty haunting, and I think it just really fits the novel and the core of Frank Herbert's novel. And then you have moments like Frank Herbert's score for this movie is unbelievable, especially that track, A Time of Quiet Between the Storms, which kind of fully fits that Across the Stars mold from Star Wars, where Across the Stars is both beautiful and romantic and idealistic, while also being haunting and scary, and you know what's coming, and this is not going to end well. And A Time of Quiet Between the Storms is this movie's version of that, and it's awesome. His score, Hans Zimmer's score throughout the movie is great. That track is great. The ending is great because he's such a huge part of nailing down the tragedy and the haunting aspect of this ending. And then just throughout the whole thing, his score is so bombastic, it's so loud, it's so in your face, as much of Denis Villeneuve's filmmaking is, and it totally works. It's what this universe, what this story needed. Also, a really smart change I think Villeneuve made that contributes to the ending, contributes to this core theme of Dune being a cautionary tale, is how he changed Chani as a character. Because obviously in the book, Chani is kind of a one-dimensional, not even a full character. And by, in this movie, making her the moral center, giving her a perspective, ending the movie on her and her sadness and her disappointment, it's obvious, but it works. And it's kind of a stroke of genius to hammer home that what Paul does is not heroic. It's actually supposed to be the opposite. It's a bad thing, and we're not supposed to be celebrating at the end. And Chani is such a huge part of getting that point across. So what Villeneuve did with her was genius. Also, credit to Timothée Chalamet's performance, his delivery of like, lead them to paradise at the end, his dejected delivery of that, how depressed he sounds. It's clear he knows exactly what's going to happen. He knows he's not leading all these people to paradise. He's leading them basically to their slaughter. And I mean, maybe in making Zendaya the moral core and really trying to hammer home those themes that maybe people missed from the Dune books, Villeneuve like loses a little bit of subtlety. And that's definitely true. I mean, there's lines where Paul goes, "Oh, I'm afraid I'll gain power," which is a great line, but they're making it very textual, what this story is about, all his visions of horror. This movie really does toe the line of making it too obvious, but I feel like they never go too far. Like, he makes it just textual and obvious enough that what he's doing is bad, and this is a cautionary tale, and religious fanaticism is bad, and messianic figures, we need to beware of them. All that stuff is there, and it's all there pretty, it's pretty obvious, but it never goes too far to be didactic or preachy or, you know, feel too overtly on the nose. Moving on from that, other stuff, just a really smart adaptation overall. Smart choices, smart script stuff, like reworking the North and the South, the geography of this movie, so that Paul going south is more of a clear line. It's a clear delineation that there's before he goes south and after he goes south, and it's a clear character moment. Or like they flesh the Fremen out more in this movie, give them more different perspectives so they're not all unified, which really works. I think keeping Alia a fetus, she's not born in this movie, is really smart, because this way it's so much creepier, it's so much scarier, and it highlights the sinister undercurrents of this movie, and again, how evil what's happening is. And that's something that maybe can get lost if we focus too much on the weirdness of this baby being born instead of the creepiness of this talking fetus, you know? Also, the way Florence Pugh is used in this movie is really smart. Making Chani a part of the prophecy is really smart. Making her a part of it and then making it not her choice and Jessica uses the voice on her and takes away her agency is really smart to, again, highlight how bad this all is. Paul finding out his ancestry, and then using that as a moment to be like, he embraces wanting to fight like a Harkonnen, which I interpreted as meaning just like charge head on, be more violent, be more direct, moving that reveal that he's a Harkonnen to the Water of Life scene instead of where it was in the book, which was in the tent scene in the first Dune. Just another really smart change. I've also noticed as I've been revisiting a lot of Villeneuve movies, how good he is with exposition. Like, he obviously creates these huge, expansive worlds where a lot of exposition is required, but the way it's written or the way it's incorporated into the dialogue, it never feels too obvious or too on the nose. Maybe it's that, maybe it's just really interesting and I don't notice it, but I feel like for a movie that is so packed full of exposition, I don't notice it all that much. And I think that's a huge testament to the script. I guess the grand theme of Villeneuve's storytelling is kind of the deceptive simplicity of it. Like, there's so many really seemingly obvious common sense storytelling techniques, like we talked about setup and payoff, little things like that, that are like, yeah, obviously he would do that. But he just executes it so well that the storytelling of the movie is kind of overlooked. But it's really pretty masterfully done. Even like simple things, like in the beginning, Paul asks Jessica, is it lethal when she's going to drink the Water of Life? And of course, her response is only for men. And then 15 minutes later, after she's taken the Water of Life, she's grabbing his wrist and she's like, you must take the Water of Life, blah, blah, blah. And that makes it all the more impactful because 15 minutes ago, she was saying men can't take it. Just simple storytelling like that makes it all the more impactful, makes this movie work. Also really love the parallels in this thing between part one and part two. Chani fighting the same way that Paul envisioned himself fighting. Paul's visions in general, the way they're always very close, but never perfectly what ends up playing out. From the Chris knife he views in number one, to Jamis as a kind of mentor. Other parallels like ending part one with a one-on-one duel versus ending part two with a one-on-one duel. Little things like that create a sense of continuity between the movies, which makes them feel like part one and part two. Even the way things are shot. There's a moment in part one where Duncan Idaho is escaping and he's flying out of Arrakis. And the way that's shot, the sound design, the air horns, is then copied exactly in a moment in part two when we go to the battle of Arrakeen and Gurney Halleck is there and blah blah blah. That's shot the exact same way, and just that continuity is really important. I feel like we've spent a lot of time on the storytelling. Let's talk about the visual stuff, the technical stuff. It's interesting how recently I went back and I rewatched Blade Runner 2049, and I love that movie. I think that movie's incredible. But in comparison to Dune, it's so interesting how that movie almost feels kind of slight, and it feels like an audition for Dune, and it feels not nearly as bombastic or loud or in your face, which is not how I remember that movie at all. And that's just a testament, I guess, to how great Dune is. It is overbearing. It is totally loud, bombastic, in your face, but it all works and you feel like you're in this other world. And for me, at least, I just want to live in this world. I want to rewatch these movies over and over and spend time in this world. Greg Fraser's cinematography for this Dune Part 2 is unbelievable. I don't know. Like, one of the hallmarks for me of a good movie is, like, it's a visual medium. It's art. So every single shot should be the most stunning possible interpretation of the words on the page. Like, good cinematography should make the most mundane dialogue scenes the most stunning thing you've ever seen. And Greg Fraser absolutely does that. Like, just show me cool things, show me cool images, show me striking things. And from the moment the opening scene starts and the color grading, and then everybody's floating up the mountain, and just instantly I knew this is going to be a good one. Or like Josh Brolin floating down the harvester. Like, there's stuff that doesn't need to be there at all, and it's definitely not in the script, but the conception of the words onto the screen is so good. Just maximum effect of what's the coolest way we can shoot this and make this the coolest thing possible. And they just nail that. It's awesome. So much other striking stuff too, like Jessica in the tent on the sandworm. I keep returning to that image in my mind. Like all the Fremen on the sandworms in the storm, and then Lady Jessica in the little tent thing, and then with the flaps. Also, it's more than just cool images. It's the scale, the use of size, it's the characters against vistas, it's the tactility of everything, the verisimilitude that's established, it's the color grading from the opening sequence, the red or orange of that sequence, to everything on Gedi Prime when it's black and white, but it's not just black and white for no reason. It's when they're inside, it's in color, and then as they walk outside, you see the color being bleached out of them because of the binary sun. Just unbelievable stuff. The final sunset. Also, it's not just beautiful composition and frames. It's camera motion, because film, again, is a dynamic, moving medium. So there's lots of really good camera work in here. Little subtle things like the focus pulling to see one thumper, and then they focus and then you see two other thumpers in the background. Or we see Javier Bardem with the flag getting ready to charge into battle, and then we pan up and then we see the huge amount of troops behind him. Little things like that. So, so good. Such great use too of like negative space. It's so weird how Villeneuve, like, he's kind of minimalist and he likes to frame just a few things against this huge expanse. He doesn't like to fill the frame with a lot of things. So it is very minimalist, but that kind of minimalism is contrasted against the maximalism of everything else, of the designs, of the scale, of the sound, of the music, and it just really works. Speaking of design work, also just like all the art direction, all the machinery, all the costumes, everything so beautiful. Let's move on to the sound design. We talked about the score. Hans Zimmer is fantastic. But then there's like design moments where Zendaya shoots down the ornithopter and the sound completely cuts out. So when she's running, you just hear her laugh. And then as the ornithopter crashes behind her, the sound comes blasting back in. The score comes back in. And it's the most like chill-inducing, amazing moment. Like, that is an example of a fantastic director taking what could be whatever music's playing, she blasts it down and it explodes, taking that and just elevating it to the next level, and it is so well done. The production design of this movie is so well done. I loved the Emperor's Planet. Even like the hallways and the corridors that Florence Pugh walks down are so stunning. The costume design and the makeup in this movie, already my pick to win at the next Oscars. Like simple stuff. Like every time we see Florence Pugh, she's in a more and more elaborate costume, and then more and more of it is looking like a cage over her face, which is obviously representative of how she feels trapped in her role as Bene Gesserit, in her future, in how she's going to end up, her fate with Paul. The elaborate robes that Jessica is in as she becomes more and more Reverend Mother, and the tattoos. And not only is it just stunning and elaborate and beautiful to look at, but it's thematically important, like the Florence Pugh thing. Also, like, you're supposed to feel weird about it, and it's supposed to be weird to see this white woman walking around and all this Middle Eastern inspired stuff, because that's also the point of the story, is the colonialism and the white people coming in and destroying these people's lives. Like, all the costume design is not only beautifully designed and just detailed and so good to look at, but it all has a thematic purpose as well, and a story purpose, and it all means something, and that is the mark of excellent work. Also, visual effects, pretty flawless for this movie. The blend of practical and CG is unparalleled. There's a shot that just blows me away every time. When the Emperor's ship comes in on Arrakis, and it's like this big, glowing, shining, metallic ball thing, and we're looking up at the reflection of the Emperor's ship, but in the reflection of the ship, you see, of course, the sands and the ground of Arrakis, but in the reflection, you also see the shadow of the ship on the sands and ground, so it's like three levels, and that was just a really impressive shot. There was not a second in this movie where I thought it looked bad or looked subpar. We talked about the design work. All the Harkonnens looked great. The wind harvesters. The little, like, gadgets they have to collect water. The editing, I think, is really good in this movie. People look at the runtime and think editing is all runtime, and they go, like, this is almost a 3-hour movie. How can it be well edited? But it absolutely is. Just like the first Dune, every single scene is important and necessary and has a payoff, and it's streamlined, and it feels like, to me, economical storytelling. The pacing is so great. I was not bored for a second in this movie. Just really well done. Even like kind of the Duncan Idaho thing we were talking about, Fade Rotha does not have that many scenes in this movie, but his impact is there and it absolutely works. Jessica does not have many scenes in this movie, but she's so important, and what scenes she has totally work. Chani and Paul's relationship is only a few scenes, but it's fully developed and it fully works, and the pacing of it fully works, and I buy into it. And then even the choices of like when we tune back into the Emperor and Florence Pugh and those moments as kind of transition scenes, the placement of those scenes are really well done. You can just feel like how well plotted this movie is, how planned out it is on a structural level. That's something I want to dive more into, is the plot construction of this movie as I continue to rewatch it. Let's see, I guess my only criticism of the editing is the kind of transition from second to third act. You can feel things missing, and you can feel that they cut some stuff out to streamline. Like, for example, we see Chani on the sandworm as they're all traveling to the south, and then the next time we see her, she flies in on an ornithopter, and we don't really get why or where she got the ornithopter from. Or Chani's best friend, Shishkali, I think is the name, she's kind of with them all as they're going to head to the south, and then next time we see her, she's captured by the Harkonnens, and we're told that she wanted to stay behind, but there feels like a little bit missing there. Like, there was probably something cut about why she stayed behind, what she did, when she offered herself to stay behind. So it goes a little fast, and you can feel scenes that were chopped out to streamline the pacing. But aside from that tiny little moment, for the rest of the movie, it's pretty flawless. So that's all the technical stuff I got. I guess let's get back into kind of story, scenes, moments I loved. The action sequences I should talk about. The opening is awesome on a visual level and just what happens. The assault on the harvester. I love the way the Fremen all pop out of the sand and just instantly sprint. Loved that. Zendaya and Paul, all that stuff trying to shoot down the ornithopter was great. The moment where we have Dave Bautista chasing down the Fremen, and then Paul gets a full Muad'Dib moment where they're killing one by one the Harkonnens, and then he comes out of the shadows, and Dave Bautista ends up running. That's a scene where it's not that important, and maybe a filmmaker would say cut it, but I love it, and it just shows you how much Paul's fighting skills have grown, and it shows you how much of a threat he's becoming as Muad'Dib, and also, it's just awesome, and it's a cool fight scene, the choreography's great, and it's just, like, amazing and cool. So there's that, there's the whole kind of montage of Rebellion, where a lot of time passes, which really works. Again, smart editing. Paul and Chani in the tent, there's a scene with them fully clothed, which is then smart, because then later on, when they're not fully clothed, you know that time has passed, their relationship has developed. Zendaya says, like, you haven't had those dreams in a while. Again, time passed, their relationship has grown, they're comfortable with each other. So much can be communicated about their relationship with just visuals, with just that one line of dialogue, and it's really well done. What other sequences? Of course, riding the sandworm. Incredible, thrilling, top-tier blockbuster stuff. It really does not get better than this. The thing that really stood out to me about that whole sequence is when Paul is finally on the sandworm and he's hooked onto it and he pulls up kind of the flap on the sandworm and it's like its nostril flap. And it's such a little thing, but it's so genius because, okay, the nostril flap, it doesn't want to get sand in its nose, so that's why it's staying on the surface of the sand, because it doesn't want sand in its nose, and that's why it's not diving down. And that tells me, and that shows me, the care and the detail that is put into every part of this universe, and there's answers to every question. Every little thing is thought out. Every sort of problem or issue we can have as an audience has already been talked about, thought out. There's an explanation, there's a reason for it, and that little moment kind of represents all of that throughout this whole movie. And I don't know, it's just a reminder that, like, we're in good hands, and it contributes to kind of the verisimilitude of this whole thing. What else? The whole Gaty Prime thing, awesome. Kind of the little gladiator stuff, amazing. Everything that goes on with this scene about the guy's not drugged, because the Baron is testing Vaedrotha, and then you've got Lea Seydoux watching the whole thing. Also, really smart editing. There's multiple different threads in that whole sequence that are all serviced, and they all make sense. Multiple different parties, different motivations, blah, blah, blah. And it all just really works. And then, of course, I have to talk about the final battle, because, like, that moment where the worms emerge, and then we're fully charging in, and it's huge, massive scale, and Zendaya's leading a team, and then there's people on the worms, and Stilgar's leading a team, and Paul's leading a team. It's just full-on chills for me. Full chills. Amazing stuff. I've seen this movie multiple times. Every time the worms come out of the dust, I still get chills. It is just excellent, excellent filmmaking. And also, like, we get the perfect amount of time with it. Runtime-wise, we don't really actually see a lot of that battle. It doesn't take long until we cut away and we're in the palace, or just in where the Emperor is. And, you know, under a lesser filmmaker, you would feel cheated and robbed and you would want more of the battle. But for me, like, they perfectly balanced giving us just enough where I was completely satisfied and I didn't feel the need to see more. But also, there's still so much more there for In Dune Messiah. If Villeneuve wants to show us the Holy War and giant full-scale battles, he can, and he can absolutely kind of surpass what he did with this final battle. And then I should also mention the final duel between Vaedrotha and Paul. So well done, so well choreographed, such a smart idea to just take out the music, take out the sound. The whole audience, you could feel everybody was on the edge of their seats. The tension is great. Everybody's invested. There's obviously the risk of it being a little bit deflating. Coming from this giant battle and going to just a one-on-one duel, it can feel a little bit like, this isn't as good. But this movie avoided that. It absolutely works. The tension, the stakes, just completely worked for me. What else did I love about this movie? Well, I can't do a Dune review without talking about the Bene Gesserit, because the Bene Gesserit are by far my favorite part of the Dune books. Just the idea of this, like, shadowy group who plants fake prophecies to then, thousands of years in the future, exploit those fake prophecies is so interesting to me. So I just love them conceptually. And then the execution of them in these movies, I love. They're just cool. They're interesting. I love a schemer. I love a planner. I love everything with Florence Pugh and her being a Bene Gesserit. I love, love, love the Leia Seydoux scene with Fade Rotha when she kind of seduces him into doing the Gom Jabbar. And then the cut to her with Reverend Mother and she's like, the bloodline is secured. It's so funny. And that scene is so great. Genuinely one of the best scenes of the movie. All the machinations, all the politics, beyond just the Bene Gesserit, like the way they're manipulating, but then also the great houses, the emperor, the way they're planning for Fade Rotha to be their next prospect or whatever. Just so good. I love all of that. And every second the Bene Gesserit are on screen, I'm just having the time of my life. I love it. I should mention the ending of this movie we've talked about. I love it ending on Zendaya. I love it ending on the Holy War. And I love Paul's dejected delivery. I love all the Fremen, like, enthusiastically cheering when you know they're all being led to their slaughter. It's pretty horrifying. And then I love, love, love everything with Jessica in the end when she's staring out the window and she's talking to the little sister and she's like, the Holy War has begun. So good. Oh, the baby worms thing. Awesome. Loved that scene where we go see Jessica and they extract the water of life from the baby sandworm. Again, it's just really cool. It's interesting. The lore of it, the world building of it. And I've just never seen anything like it. So I loved that scene. I think now let's move into performances and characters. I love with this movie that you can feel like the new generation of movie stars kind of being legitimized, being solidified. This is like them all making it to the big leagues. And obviously, first and foremost of that group is Timothée Chalamet as Paul. He's so good. He's great in this movie. He was great in the first one, and I think he's even better in this one. What I was worried about, because he's not a big guy, he's pretty slim, and I was worried about the switch when he does finally embrace his role and he has to command all these people. Am I really going to buy into this guy being the leader? And he absolutely sold it for me, which was by far, in my opinion, the biggest achievement of his performance. That whole turning point scene where Paul storms into the kind of war conference and he finally accepts his role, and it's so great. And from there on till the very end of the movie, I just had like full body chills. It was so well done. I loved it. But I feel like that's getting so much attention. And what's not getting attention is when he's still in the South and he's crying because he knows what's going to happen and he doesn't want it to happen. And I love that scene because I love the desperation of it. I love how this whole movie, everyone has been pushing him in one direction, and this is finally his release of, like, this sucks, I don't want to do this, but he finally succumbs to the pressure, and he does it, because it's, you know, the only way to save his family. And I just love that scene, I love his change. I love how, after he takes the water of life, whatever hope he may have had that he's not going to embrace this role, blah blah blah, goes away as he realizes it's the only way. I love Jessica, like, whispering in the crowd, still, like, advising him, you're going too fast, blah, blah, blah. Like, and then we get to the point where at the end, he's stomping his feet at the Emperor to kiss his ring, or he's leading this giant crowd of thousands of Fremen. And I was worried about it, but when you watch the movie, I absolutely buy it. I buy that they're following him. I buy that he's leading them. I buy that he's making the Emperor kiss his ring. He sold it. And I think that's a massive, massive accomplishment. And props to Chalamet for selling something I didn't think he was going to be able to sell. Also, Greg Fraser, Denis Villeneuve, the way he's shot, especially in comparison of Dune 1 to Dune 2, there's lots of like shots looking down on him. He's a little more measly in the first one. And then when he switches, it's more silhouettes. It's more from behind. It's more shot up at him to make him more powerful and strong and make him the Lisa Nagaib. So that was cool. Zendaya, I love how her performance in this really enriches part one, because part one, if you remember, opens with her narration, and that narration ends with who will our next oppressors be, and that totally lines up with her whole philosophy in this movie, and she's really great. Her role is almost entirely reaction shots to everything going on, and she really sells it. I think of like Paul riding the sandworm, and at first she's super happy and celebratory, and then she looks over at Stilgar and she sees Stilgar bowing, and she realizes how people are worshiping Paul, and then she's scared and her face changes, and it's just really well done. Zendaya does just have that kind of star power. She stands out. Even like in the beginning in Siege Tabor, she stands out against all the other Fremen. You can't take your eyes off her. There's a part of her that feels kind of too glamorous in Hollywood, and she doesn't really fit in, which may be a problem in a different role, but in this role, it's the point, and she's supposed to stand out to Paul, and she's supposed to be special and different, and it absolutely works. I said all the reaction shots are great. I think her chemistry, her romance with Chalamet, really great. They sell that romance really well. I love moments where they're just kind of like sand walking together in the dark, and the score, super great. We talked about her as the moral center, kind of the heartbreaking ending, which is really great. You feel for her and you feel her pain. I mean, it's all kind of summarized in that line where she says to him, "I will always love you as long as you stay who you are." And that part is the condition that he breaks. And that's what kind of leads to her ending. And just a great line summarizing her character, summarizing the theme of the story. Okay, next up is Rebecca Ferguson, who for my money was MVP of this movie. I loved her in the first one. Lady Jessica is my favorite character in the first one and in this one. In the beginning of this movie, like the opening scene, she's telling Paul to shush. She saves him from the Harkonnen and tells him not to, you know, turn his back to the open. It instantly reestablishes her as the old Jessica, the part one Jessica, who cares about her son, who is all about protecting her son, who will do anything to protect her son. But the conflict for that character is the pull between those motherly instincts and the Bene Gesserit in her, and her greater purpose for Paul. And her whole character in part one is trying to basically reconcile those two things. And in part two, as she takes the water of life, basically those two things become one thing. Her motherly instincts are still there and she still cares about her son, but she's realizing that the only way to protect him is to embrace the Bene Gesserit, embrace the prophecy, push him towards the prophecy. And it's almost jarring at first. Like in part two, she's a very different character, and it almost can feel out of step with part one. But when you think about it and you think about her motivations and you think about the water of life and how she probably sees everything and sees that this is the only way to continue what she started in the first movie, it absolutely makes sense and it works. And I absolutely love the way she's used. I love that character change for her. Really, it fits along the lines of this kind of motif throughout this whole movie of choices, or the lack of choices. Paul is trying to resist against fate, but he doesn't have a choice and he does it. Florence Pugh doesn't really have a choice. She's trapped. Chani doesn't have a choice. The voice is used on her in the prophecy. To what extent do we have choices, and to what extent are things forced upon us? is kind of the question the story is asking, and I think this movie explores it really well. Also, love anytime Jessica uses the voice. Love when Paul uses it too on Reverend Mother in the end. That's a great moment, paralleling the first one. I love how after Jessica takes the water of life, how scary she becomes and sinister. And it's a change from the book because in the book, yeah, she pushes Paul. She wants him to be the Lisan al-Ghaib, but they don't highlight how scary it is and how evil it is. And in this movie, they absolutely do. She is scary. She's sinister. She's whispering to this unborn baby while staring at these cowering children hiding, saying we need to convert them and we need to start with the ones who are scared of us. Like, she is flat out evil in this movie, and it is so important to highlighting that sinister aspect and highlighting how evil this all is. She is a force, and she in so many ways is the force that drives this movie, and I absolutely love it. All her scenes are my favorite scenes. I love how creepy she is. Anya Taylor-Joy appears as grown-up Alia Atreides in the scene where Paul takes the water of life. Loved that. Love that casting. Love that scene too, and her appearance in it, and Arrakis as a paradise, which will never happen. And I can't wait for Dune Messiah, and assumably she'll have a big role in it as grown-up Alia, and I can't wait for that. Next up is Javier Bardem as Stilgar. He is so great in this. There's a good case for him being MVP too. He starts out very funny, and his religious devotion to Paul is funny, and it's comedic, and, you know, he is humble like the Mahdi, or talking about the djinn, or constantly shouting Lisan al-Ghaib at everything he does, is very funny and comedic, and totally works. And the humor is not quippy MCU humor. The humor is based on character and just who this guy is, which is obviously always the better type of humor. So all that works. And I love how the thing you're laughing at then becomes scary later on in the movie as, you know, what happens happens. And it starts out as funny and comedic, but becomes pretty horrifying and terrible. And you're suddenly like, whoa, calm down, Stilgar. But obviously he doesn't. Javier Bardem is fantastic. He does completely disappear into this role for me. Josh Brolin, really great. Sells his whole relationship with Paul with not much. He's kind of solid. He's a little more of a narrative device to just kind of push Paul along his journey, but I liked him. Also liked him getting his revenge on Dave Bautista. I would have liked that scene to be a little bit longer, but also part of me likes that it's not, because it highlights just how much of a coward Bautista is, and Beast Rabban or whatever his name is. Speaking of Bautista, he's great. Love how he's a coward. He goes out like a coward. He does a great job, like, acting tough, but then instantly he's running away from Paul, or he's just, like, shaking before going to talk to the Baron. Really great. But then he's also brutal. They highlight the brutality of the Harkonnens really well in this movie. They do definitely kind of strip out any of the Mentats. I missed David Desmalchian in this. I would have liked to see him. I missed Thufir Hawat. So I'm a little bummed, but I completely understand. And if it's a choice between Mentats and Bene Gesserit, I will choose Bene Gesserit every day. I mentioned the Baron. Stellan Skarsgård is fantastic. Completely disappears into the role. He's great. Austin Butler is awesome in this movie. Completely deranged. Love his Stellan Skarsgård impersonation with the voice. Also love how you can hear tinges of Elvis still in there. It's crazy how much he looks like Alex Skarsgård too in this movie. I love the whole sexual aspect of him and how they say he's sexually vulnerable, and the moments where he's like clearly aroused by Paul killing his uncle, or in the duel with Paul, or at these moments of violence, he's very aroused, and he's just kind of like this crazy, insane, deranged freak, and just totally works as an effective villain. Christopher Walken is great. I love how this performance is completely stripped back. He's not going full on Walken, he's just kind of just saying the lines, and that's been a little bit controversial. And people are like, well, he's kind of distracting that it's just Christopher Walken and he's just kind of flatly delivering lines. But to me, it absolutely worked because I see this guy as this scheming shark, but he was a guy who was once sharp, once clever, once super powerful, but is now kind of falling from grace and he's aging. And you still see that a little bit in his eyes, but it's leaving him and the houses see weakness and everyone sees weakness in him. And that's what's being exploited. And I thought Walken was perfect casting for that whole thing because he does still radiate power. And when he's sitting on the throne, he looks like he belongs on the throne, but you feel like this guy maybe 30 years ago was even more powerful and some of it's leaving him. Also love the scene where he gets the message from Paul and all he does is just drop it and then Florence Pugh picks it up. Such a great scene. Speaking of Florence Pugh, she is fantastic. Her narration is great. Her costumes are great. She's also doesn't get much interiority besides like her reactions and her facial expressions when Paul says what he says and makes the offer and her reaction to that. And then when she looks at Zendaya and you see her realization of kind of the trap, the cage she's walking right into, and also how that's going to be served in Messiah with what happens to that character and how trapped she feels. Really just great stuff. Love the way they incorporated her like journaling and her encyclopedia entries and that stuff from the book into the movie. So love that. Florence Pugh's great. Charlotte Rampling does not get enough attention, but she is so great in this movie. I love her as Reverend Mother. She just knows how to deliver every single line with the perfect amount of like force and power. And she's just perfect. All the looks between her and Jessica, the little like self-satisfied smirk when Jessica like is basically like told you so with Paul. And then when she calls Paul an abomination, all that is great. And I'm very curious to see if she's going to be in Dune Messiah and what her role will be. Who else? Lea Seydoux, fantastic. She got one of the best scenes of the movie. I hope to see a lot more of her in Messiah. And last but not least, I wanted to give some credit to, I think it's Suhelia Jacob, who plays Shishkali, who's Zendaya's best friend in this movie. And her role's kind of understated, but she's great. She does a lot of heavy lifting in making Zendaya still feel like a Fremen, because she does stand out so much, and this character is so important for grounding Zendaya as a Fremen. She's also just great line delivery. She gets some good lines. You totally believe her in this world, and she kind of kills it in a really small and kind of thankless role. And with that, my voice is dying, so I think I'm going to bring it to a close. I feel like I've covered pretty much everything, while also somehow barely scratching the surface, which is how it usually goes with a movie I love so much like Dune. But that's my thoughts on Dune Part 2. Absolutely love this movie. I cannot wait for Dune Messiah. It's going to be different. It's going to be controversial. It's not at all like these first two, and I cannot wait for that. What did you think of Dune Part 2? Did you prefer it to Part 1? I'm very curious to hear what people thought of it. So thank you so much for listening. And have a good day.